Dark purple clouds hung ominously high in the Nevada sky. A sheet of lightning flashed brightly, momentarily parting the roiling cover to expose a fiery orange sky. The Sticky lifted his head from the dead bear he was eating and surveyed the weedy landscape. Usually, loud noises were good. Explosions and fire always meant norms were nearby, and they sometimes had prizes worth stealing. But this was different somehow. Timidly, the worried Sticky looked at the stormy sky. There was a kind of rain that fell sometimes, every drop burning worse than fire. Sluggishly, Demuti recalled that the fire rain had a very specific smell, similar to old bird eggs, and there was no trace of the fire rain smell. This had to be something else, something new, perhaps. Suddenly, an armored war wag plowed through the row of trees, the heavy treads flattening the laurel bushes into pulp. The Sticky rose to wave both sucker-covered hands at the strange, angular beast. Then, it charged in attack. Rolling and carrying over the bodies, the lead APC crushed them in the mud and rocks, as three more war wags appeared from the forest. Each of the armored machines was draped with sandbags for additional protection, the windows only tiny slits to prevent an enemy from shooting inside the vehicles. Instead of wheels, they rolled on armored treads, and the vented barrels of rapid fires jutted from each side like the quills of a porcupine. On the top of the lead wag was a scarred dome, the stubby barrel of a 20mm Vulcan minigun sweeping the opposite shoreline for any possible dangers. Sparkling with droplets, the war wags lumbered up the opposite bank.
It's back on target.
It took two tries because of the cramped quarters, but the man finally got the Webley 44 wheel gun back in the leather. As bald as a rock, Bellany sported an enormous head that seemed to merge with his incredibly hairy chest. His clothes were clean but heavily patched, and crew tattoos were visible on every inch of his exposed skin. A machete hung at his side, tucked in a rattlesnake skin sheath.
Well, that's a waste of ammo.
The gauges on the illuminated dashboard flickered in response. As the wag surged forward, a piece of the dead Sticky came loose and fell off the array of welded iron bars covering the windshield. Unconcerned, Bellany shrugged as he reached for the half-eaten sandwich lying on the dashboard.
Don't worry about it. We got plenty.
The driver was a newbie to the convoy and still had trouble getting his head around the idea of having enough ammo. All of his life, the man had watched grim people fight to the death with fists, knives, and clubs over the ownership of a single live brass. Yet the four wags of the convoy had cases of the stuff. Upon joining the convoy, the driver had been given a leather gun belt containing a pristine S&W 357 revolver, with double row of loops across the back holding a total of 30 live brass. But that was nothing compared to the stack of boxes stored in the armory. Grands, rockets, all kinds of stuff. How the chief kept finding it, the driver had no idea. Along with the weapons, Chief Rogan often unearthed pre-dark medical supplies. Crystals that you could dissolve in water and drink to cure the black cough, the blind shakes, all sorts of ills. The meds were worth 1,000 times more than any gun, yet the chief regularly gave them away. At first that seemed like an incredible waste, but whenever they returned to those vills, the convoys were greeted warmly, and nobody tried to jack them in the night, sell them rad water, or any of the other feeble tricks some locals used to rip off outlanders. Bellany studied a hand-drawn map, then checked the compass on the dashboard, before raising his head to note the landscape outside.
Now that we've made the river, there should be a bunch of foothills, then a deep valley.
He grabbed a mic from a clip attached to the ceiling.
Okay, everybody get ready.
Somebody wake up the chief. We're almost there.
And sooner than expected.
Bellany smiled in greeting at the man standing in the doorway.
We didn't run into any trouble like last time, sir.
Then what were you shooting at?
The chief was wearing a military jumpsuit, bleached a dull gray to match his pale combat boots. Two different weapons rode in a wide gun belt, and a short crystal wand was tucked into a shoulder holster. The others had no idea what the thing was, but naturally assumed it was a weapon of some kind.
Just a Sticky. Nothing important.
Sticky, huh? Well, as you say, nothing important.
The man who called himself John Rogan limped across the convoy wag and took a seat. Bellany forced himself not to comment on the man's condition. Pale and thin, the chief always looked rather sickly, a condition that had tricked a lot of Coltharts into trying to kill the Norm for his weapons. But the chief was still here, while the others were now residents in the Worm Motel. In spite of appearances, he was lightning fast with a gun, and rarely missed. Privately, Bellany thought it was more than possible that the chief had just a touch of Muti in his blood, but wisely never mentioned the idea out loud. Chief Rogan hated all Mutis with a violence that bordered on madness. Studying the grill covering the front windshield, the chief buckled on the seatbelt, usually ignored by all of the other members of his crew. There were some scattered bloodstains on the metal, but no appreciable damage.
It took me quite a while to steal these four wags from the Alaska Redoubt controlled by Department Coldfire. Getting replacements is totally out of the question. If another operative of Coldfire ever finds me, worse, somebody from Titan, I'll be executed on sight. But the fools cannot kill what they cannot find.
The cyborg roused himself from his thoughts and addressed the driver.
How's the fuel?
Halfway down.
That's acceptable.
The cyborg looked outside as the driver steered around the ruins of a pre-dark house. The roof and walls had crumbled to the ground long ago, leaving only the brick chimney. But as the war wags rumbled past, the chimney visibly trembled and broke apart, finishing the destruction. For some bizarre reason, the random destruction felt ominous, almost as if it was a premonition of doom. The cyborg tried to shake off the dire thoughts. He was a realist. He didn't believe in omens and portents. Yet the disturbing feeling would not leave the man-machine hybrid, and he stared at the cloud of dust rising from the wreckage until the natural contour of the land removed it from his sight.
Could there be death waiting for me in these ruins, as Haviva foretold? But she warned me of teeth in the water. There's no water here, only crumbling brick buildings, blast craters, and weeds.
Sir, is there something wrong? Hey, Chief!
With a start, the cyborg realized that Bellany had been talking to him for a while.
No. Just lost in thought over that redhead from the last Ville. By thunder, she was fantastic. Damn near chilled me in bed. And that was before she pulled a knife and tried to gut me like a fish.
Just a greedy slut. And you paid her two live rounds. She wanted it all, but she ended up with nothing.
Sad, but true.
Actually, he had been forced to slay the whore when he lost control for a second during their sex play and accidentally revealed his true self, the beams of light from his cybernetic eyes shining directly into her horrified face. She'd shrieked in terror, and he'd quickly pulled a knife to slash her throat, then cut his own arm to try to cover up the murder. Thankfully, the local Sekhmen believed his story, especially when he insisted on having another slut finish what the first one had only started. A normal man denied release would see completion, so he'd had to do the same. Anything else would have been deemed suspicious. Annoying, but necessary. In the end, it had cost Delphi another live round in payment, but the cyborg had sex with another slut, finally crying out in pretend joy, when inside he was seething with impatience to leave.
If this mission is successful, I will never have to do such foul, degrading things again. I'll have no need for the troopers of this convoy, or these ramshackle old war machines. I will be whole, complete, indomitable.
Struggling to control his breathing, the cyborg rubbed his bad leg, remembering his disastrous fight with Doc Tanner in the underground tunnel.
Soon enough, Tanner. Oh, so very soon, revenge will be mine. Only this time, I'm not going after you. That would be too swift, too easy. This time, I'm going to destroy your only reason for staying alive.
Hey, look! Is that the place?
Looks like it. What do you think, sir?
The assimilation of John Rogan looked out the window. The wag was parked on top of a hillock, and down below were the sprawling remains of some pre-dark city. Most of the structures had been leveled, and remained only as square outlines in the thick carpeting of weeds and scraggly bushes. 100 cars were parked neatly in grassy fields that had once been a busy city street. The cyborg realized that the bronze statue of the town's founder was nowhere in sight. The mall was now a scum-covered pond. The nuke damage to the town seemed minimal. Sierra Nevada College was a liberal arts college, and not on anybody's ICBM hit list. However, its graphic arts department had a Nexus Generation IBM Blue Gene supercomputer used to train students for creating state-of-the-art computer games and special effects in movies. And the cyborg wanted it.
I'm not sure.
He augmented his vision for telescopic sight. Hundreds of assorted ruins zoomed into view, and he studied them carefully. Several of the college buildings still remained, the thick marble walls covered with moss and dense growths of wild ivy. Nevada had not been hit too hard during the war, but it had been torn to pieces by earthquakes, a volcano, and the mindless rioting that soon followed Skydark. Add to that the general destruction of the acid rainstorms, and suddenly locating the graphic arts lab was less than a sure bet. As he searched for additional landmarks, the other wags arrived to park in a ragged line alongside the lead wag. Accessing his mental files, the cyborg compared his memory of the university town to the present-day jumble of weeds and broken sidewalks. Overlapping the two images, Delphi saw that too much had shifted over time, and he was forced to sneak a peek at his palm. The nanotech monitor embedded into his flesh came into view for a moment, then faded away again. The replacement hand was not yet fully interfaced with his internal circuitry, but the brief scan had been enough.
Yes, this is it. Daniel, take us down the hill, but move slow. I cannot vouch for the stability of the subterranean aqueducts.
The driver blinked in confusion.
The sewers are damaged, and the streets may collapse. At the first sign of tilting, head into the weeds.
No problem, Chief.
As the armored wag began to roll, the cyborg activated the electric circuits to the 20mm Vulcan minigun on the roof. He had a very limited supply of rounds for the Vulcan, mainly because at maximum discharge, it could empty the entire vehicle of shells in under 5 minutes. Sluggishly, a vid monitor on the dashboard flickered and scrolled into life, displaying a static-filled view of the land directly ahead of them. A graduated crosshairs appeared on the screen. Even in his time period, this was an awesome weapon of destruction.
Zane, contact the other wags. I want Margaret and Vance to stay on top of the hill and keep a watch on us from a safe distance. Evan is to stay close.
Margaret and Vance, keep watch at the top of the hill. Evan, stay near.
The cyborg squeezed the trigger on the joystick.
Damn, you're fast.
Bellany raised an eyebrow as the remains of a dead muti dropped onto the dirt.
I never even saw the bastard muti.
Which is why the chief's in charge, and why I drive, and Etta is the healer, and you... Exactly what is it you do here again?
Giving a half smile, Bellany smacked the driver across the back of the head.
Ow! Oh yeah, now I remember.
As the wag crested over the hillock, a wide expanse of greenery spread out before it. The field of low grass became dotted with low bushes that merged together into a dense undergrowth. Obviously, there had been a forest fire here in recent years, or perhaps acid rain, and the soil was only now reclaiming the lost territory. The war wag went over the bushes without any hindrance. Reaching level ground, young saplings grew in abundance, pine, birch, and willow. The rad counter on the dashboard began to move wildly, and Daniel abruptly veered away from the lake. It had to be a blast crater that had filled with water over time. A perforated metal pole stuck out of the ground, and Daniel headed in that direction. Soon enough, bits of pre-dark trash were visible among the weeds and plants. Pieces of dark asphalt appeared here and there among the plants, and Daniel used them as a guide through the suburbs and into the ancient city. Soon the fledgling trees gave way to vertical walls of thick moss, and vines extended in every direction. Bright red umbrella bushes stood like fiery giants amid the greenery, clusters of tiny birds fluttering about inside the tangled maze of twisted branches. The strange bushes were not a mutation, but simply vegetation indigenous to Puerto Rico. How it got to North America was anybody's guess. Most likely there had been a few samples in the college greenhouse, and after the nuclear war, they began to spread. The cyborg had encountered lions in Texas and elephants in Maine. When humanity tried to kill itself, the zoos of the world were left alone, neglected. Some of the starving animals weren't eaten and managed to escape and breed in the wild. Which unfortunately did not explain the howlers. Those mutations were not listed on any of the cyborg's files or records. Howlers were not genetic experiments designed to survive a nuclear war, nor biological weapons, organic killing machines created by the military to combat the growing mutant population. No, they were something else, something different and unknown. Privately, the cyborg feared they were true mutations, Mother Nature's savage response to the atomic rape of the planet. Someday, they would have to be eliminated, or else humanity would find itself embroiled in another war for survival. More and larger buildings could be seen among the thick carpeting of moss, along with the occasional upright door or intact window. A gleaming white satellite dish thrust up from an ivy-covered building. The fire escape festooned with gently waving flowers. A few battle tanks were visible. Clearly, somebody had known what was going on inside the quiet college, but had arrived far too late to do anything about it. Finally, the war wag reached an open area.
Okay, this will do.
Yes, sir.
Only a few yards away was a weed-encrusted fountain, the legs of a bronze statue rising from the amassed plants to end in ragged stumps above the thighs.
We make camp here. There's good visibility in all directions. Nothing can get close without us seeing it.
You expecting trouble, Chief?
Bellamy took a Kalashnikov assault weapon from the gun rack.
No, just preparing for it.
On the dashboard, a second set of gauges and meters came to slow life, using the power from the nuke batteries inside the floor. Fuel for the motors was difficult to acquire outside of a redoubt, but the nuke batteries supplied electricity for decades before burning out.
What exactly are we after here, anyway?
Shine, sluts, and slaves?
Hardly. There's a lot of old tech here that we can incorporate, that we can use in the WAGs. Maybe even get the radios to work for farther than a couple of hundred feet.
Working radios? That'd give us a chilling edge in any fight with another WAG. We gotta try for those.
Exactly, my friend. My thoughts exactly.
The second WAG rolled into view and came to a halt only a few yards away. The side hatch cycled open, lowering to the ground to form a short flight of stairs. Two armed troopers jumped down from the WAG and stood in a crouched position to give the other troopers inside the WAG needed clearance to fire. All of the men were carrying Browning automatic rifles, heavy bolt-action weapons from the Second World War. Only one person was carrying a Kalashnikov, a short, red-headed woman who was the sec boss for the second WAG. Looking over the ivy-covered ruins, Cotton Davenport walked outside to join the troopers. Next came two more troopers carrying Browning long rifles, but these had bayonets attached to the ends of the barrels. The blades shone mirror bright in the weak sunlight, radiating downward from the stormy sky. Both of the guards wore bandoliers slung across their chests, the loops full of shiny brass cartridges.
Okay, spread out and do a perimeter sweep. I want a 50-yard wreck in every direction. You find anything, chill it.
Nodding, the four troopers headed off in different directions, their weapons held at the ready. As the cyborg exited his WAG, he stretched his sore muscles because it was expected. Bellany stayed at his side as Cotton and four more troopers joined the procession. Two of them wore bulky backpacks, and one man openly carried a crowbar. Everybody carried lanterns and grins. The group moved deeper into the ruins. Vines were thick underfoot, making walking tricky business, and little white mushrooms were everywhere. There was a small banana tree in the smashed display window of a clothing store, and clusters of an unknown fruit festooned a public library. There was a large spider web filling an alleyway between two buildings. A large snake on a second-floor balcony stared unnervingly at the norms as they moved past. It was the jungle of Nevada. With the weather patterns of the world so scrambled, it was a miracle that anybody had survived Skydark. Going to the cracked marble basin of the old fountain, the cyborg located the broken statue. The rest of the figure was lying amid the leafy ivy and kudzu. The bronze turned a dark green from a century of corrosion.
Is that their baron or some kind of god?
The statue was of a man carrying a long rifle and powder horn, so it had to be a Sekhmen of some kind. He'd seen hunters wearing the same kind of fringed clothing back east.
The great-grandfather of their baron is more like it.
The cyborg ran calculations inside his head. If the Boston Minuteman had been facing the southeast, then the main road should be to their right. Hopefully, the physics lab was still standing, or else this whole trip would be a waste. The cyborg only had limited resources since being thrown out of Department Coldfire, and every failure threatened his very existence. He had been terminated because of his failure to retrieve the test subject, aka Dr. Theophilus Tanner. The occasional lack of success on a mission was to be expected in the chaos of the Deathlands, but the cyborg had also broken too many rules, slaughtered too many gene-pure people in his mad quest for Tanner. All would have been forgiven if he had accomplished the task, But this level of failure meant his doom. Knowing he had only minutes in which to act, the cyborg known as Delphi had reluctantly killed his friend and used his ident card to raid the main warehouse for spare body parts and supplies, then established a supply cache at an abandoned redoubt. Now he walked the planet amid the dirty savages, posing as a trader, exchanging trinkets for food, and buying the loyalty of men with guns and bullets, searching, hunting, committed to another desperate quest, this time to gain his own salvation.
Well, nuke me running. I never would have supposed he had flintlocks back then. I thought that was something new.
Yeah? And who the fuck has new flintlocks?
Come on. I think the building is this way.
Delphi rushed off by himself as the others scrambled to catch up. There was an old skeleton lashed to the cross on top of a sagging church, only the ropes and jungle vines holding the dried bones in place. A plastic rosary still hung from the broken neck of the Catholic priest, a fiberglass arrow shaft going through his ribs, exactly where his heart would have been located. Another jutted from the left eye socket. Delphi knew that after Skydark, most of the survivors went temporarily mad. Terrified and starving, they turned against any symbol of authority, police officers, physicians, judges, and even the clergy, killing the very people who could have helped them stay alive. Not many people could read these days, and the word whitecoat was the most vile curse word. Advanced technology was suspect and considered magic by most norms. Traveling across the scorched continent, Delphi had no trouble finding Sekhmet to join his convoy. Guns with unlimited ammo was a lure that none could resist, but very few wanted anything to do with the engines, power plant, or electronic machinery.
Oh, this place makes my skin crawl. It's evil. I can feel it.
Frag that noise. Watch for scream wings and stay with the chief.
Delphi looked around, then charged in a fresh direction. The main street of the ruins was made of red bricks, partially crumbled back into the moist earth, with weed and dill growing thick between the irregular rows. A large metallic shape filled an intersection, and Delphi thought it was another army tank at first. But as he got closer, he realized it was the bent wreckage of an ICBM missile, probably one of the many that had been shot down during the brief war. The ceramic nose cone was still attached, and the cyborg nervously checked for any signs of life from the thermonuclear death machine, or worse, a radiation leak. But the missile registered as magnetically inert, and there was only the low-level background radiation that blanketed the world these days. This specimen of the weapons that had killed the world was dead. Moving around the missile, Delphi paused, then moved forward with renewed vigor.
Here it is.
The graphic arts building of the college was still standing, the marble walls intact, even if the facade was slightly tilting to the left, so that the front door was now a trapezoid. The window glass for all five stories was long gone, but stout bars still covered the lopsided openings.
What a pit.
You sure there's anything useful here, Chief?
Absolutely.
Delphi moved towards the encrusted remains of the revolving door. The shatterproof glass was also missing from the frame, and he easily stepped through the portal and into the dim interior. The terrazzo floor was thick with dirt, only a very few small plants having found the necessary perches to grow on the resilient material. The furnishings in the lobby were draped with vines, the ceiling thick with cobwebs, and there was a definite reek of mildew in the air. Automatically, Delphi activated his nasal filters, just in case there was any black mold in the structure.
Use your handkerchiefs.
The cyborg pulled the knotted cloth over his nose and mouth. Proceeding deeper into the building, Delphi felt his artificial eyes come alive and start to glow to counter the darkness. Instantly, he countermanded the process and pulled around the lantern, hanging at his side. The wick burned with an eerie blue light from the alcohol in the glass reservoir, which only served to give the darkness an additional unearthly feel. As the others did the same, the lobby came to life, and Delphi could now see the trappings of civilization. Dead security cameras mounted on the walls, an ATM in the corner, payphones, an alcove filled with candy and soda machines. Looking around the lobby, Delphi saw two sets of double doors at opposite ends. One set was broken and hanging from the rusted hinges, the other still in place. The glass in the observation port cracked, but intact. The doors proved to be firmly locked. The IBM supercomputer had cost the college several million dollars. He had expected some decent security, Not this good. Suddenly, he felt a tingling rush of excitement. This could be the answer to his prayers. Not just a college, but a top-secret military laboratory.
Blow it!
The troopers with the backpacks moved up, pulling out blocks of C4 plastique. Taking over the work, Bellany cut the big blocks into small squares and attached them to the outside of the doors where the hinges should be located on the other side. The trooper trailed the detonator wiring behind him as he got clear, then attached them to a small handheld generator.
Watch it! Hot plas!
Cotton wiped her stinging eyes with the back of a hand.
That fucking boom might bring every muti in the area down on our nuking throats!
Hurrying closer, Delphi was stunned to see that the doors had not been removed, but instead were merely separated by a few feet. The adamantine portal still attached to the locking bar on the inside. However, the massive hinges were twisted and stretched like warm taffy, leaving a gap between the doors of about a foot.
Shit. They sure built things strong before the big chill. That plasma charge should have knocked down the whole damn wall.
Ah, but this is no ordinary building, Bellany.
Delphi held the lantern next to the gap.
I think this might have been a mill base.
A fort? Thought you said it was a school.
A little of both, and so much more. Now, stay close and follow my lead.
Turning sideways, Delphi managed to squeeze through the slim opening. There was another long corridor ahead of him, but this one was spotlessly clean, without any dust, vines, or mold. The air past the doors was flat, tasting rather similar to that of a redoubt, sterile and clean. The installation seemed to be intact. Unable to restrain himself further, Delphi ran forward past numerous doors marked only with project code names, Broken Thunder, Delta Dawn, Maelstrom and the like, until reaching a plain door marked simply as Cold Fire.
Eureka!
The cyborg pressed in an entry code onto the keypad, and there was no response, which was not very surprising. Even the vaunted nuke batteries had limits. Glancing behind to make sure the others coming through the doors were not close yet, the cyborg pushed up a sleeve and opened a small service panel in his arm. Pulling out a power cord, he attached it to the port of the keypad and tried again. Quickly, he reclaimed the power cord, just as Bellany, Davenport, and the others arrived.
Don't like you going off by yourself, Chief. What if you found a sticky or a canny hiding in there?
I was in no danger. Now, I want the rest of you to stay here in the hallway. I must do the next part alone.
Sir, I just said I don't...
I'll be fine.
Delphi was unable to look away from the darkness. Everything he wanted, everything he needed, could be only a few feet away.
Besides, you need to keep guard.
No.
What was that you just said?
I said no. Where you go, so do we, Chief. End of discussion.
Impatiently, Delphi started to rally cogent arguments, but then saw the grim determination in the trooper's face and accepted the situation. The only way to stop the man from following would be to kill him. Delphi had no real problem with that, but there were too many others that would also have to be killed, and in the ensuing fight, some of their bullets might damage the delicate equipment inside the pre-dark lab, ruining the whole reason for coming here in the first place.
All right, but we stay together.
I'm on point.
Bellany stepped in front of the cyborg and walked boldly into the blackness. Holding their weapons at the ready, the other troopers stayed close to Delphi. The floor was bare concrete, thick power cables crisscrossing the expanse in a manner shockingly similar to the jungle outside. A massive supercomputer stood mute along a cinder block wall, the huge tanks of liquid nitrogen used to cool the machine standing in a neat row inside a chained corral. Mountains of machinery rose and fell around the group, the shadows cast by their alcohol lanterns making the equipment seem oddly animated.
So what are we looking for?
Shit! It really stinks in here. Kind of reminds me of a latrine.
That smell. Beauty!
Delphi dashed his hurricane lantern to the floor. The alcohol ignited, creating a rush of light that caught something large and dark just outside the nimbus of illumination.
Go back to back! Form a circle!
Bellany raised his gun.
No! Don't shoot!
The shadows moved again. Suddenly, a trooper's arm was torn off at the shoulder, taking his Browning with it. As the others rushed to his aid, Cotton spun with her Kalashnikov. The muzzle flash strobed in the darkness, almost revealing something darting between the huge machines.
Damn it, no shooting! That is an order!
Shit, there's two of them!
A startled trooper pulled out a Gren. Aghast, Delphi pointed the rapid fire at the man and was about to shoot when there was movement above the group and a large black creature landed in the middle of them. The blue flames rose around the mutie, apparently doing no harm to it whatsoever, but revealing every feature. It was a huge dog-like creature, almost the size of a pony. The smooth fur was dead black, the mouth a crimson slash, the long fangs dripping blood, and the eyes were solid yellow. Then a writhing nest of tentacles rose from the back.
Fuck me, it's a hellhound!
As the injured trooper backed away, he toppled over, revealing a second mutie. The mutie retreated into the gloom, with most of the trooper's spine dangling from its horrid jaws. Dropping his AK-47, Bellamy spun in a crouch and drew the Webley. The booming muzzle flame actually touched the hellhound, scoring a long bloody curl along its side. The monster charged through the crowd of troopers, escaping into the darkness. The discharges lit the pre-dark lab as the two hellhounds circled the group, going in different directions, constantly moving.
Sons of bitches are trying to confuse us! How smart are these muties?
The light from the smashed lantern was beginning to flicker and die. As the illumination diminished, the hellhounds came ever closer. Oddly, the monster seemed unconcerned about the other lanterns.
It's not the light! They don't like fire!
Gee, is there anything in here we can burn?
I have no idea!
Suddenly, one of the creatures leapt on top of a computer, then leapt back down again. The big machine tilted, and men scrambled away.
The eyes! Aim for the eyes or the ears! Those are the only weak points!
The troopers shuffled closer together for protection.
You are the man! Eyes and ears, boys! Send it to hell!
Delphi lowered his exhausted weapon and pulled a pistol from his gun belt. At the grasp of his hand, the weapon charged, and an indicator light on top registered in the red. The battery inside the H&K needler was fully ready.
Everybody out!
Delphi leveled the Kalashnikov and his pistol.
I can handle this alone!
No nuke and wave! We stand together!
Ducking, the bald trooper cracked the weapon to drop the empties. A hellhound jumped over a desk for Bellamy.
Mutie bastard!
Single swipe of the powerful claws removed Bellamy's throat. While the tentacles lanced outward, spearing two other troopers, scoring minor wounds. Delphi paused for only a second, then aimed both of his weapons at the mutie. 7.62mm bullets bounced off the body of the beast, but the 2.5mm depleted uranium slivers punched clean through the sleek muscular body. The mutie pumped out piss-yellow blood as its tentacles stabbed for the cyborg. Delphi ducked, and they missed by less than an inch. Staying in a crouch, he held his weapons out again. Now the others trained their weapons on the wounded beast. The creature sprang for the cyborg and missed, but knocked the Kalashnikov out of his hands, taking the needler along with it. But as the animal landed on the desk, Cotton shoved her AK-47 into one of its ears.
Yeah!
They were now able to concentrate on the last man killer. Trying for the nimble creature, they succeeded only in finishing the destruction of the pre-dark lab. Recovering his needler, Delphi saw another trooper fall and made a command decision. The resources of the lab were already lost. It was time to save what he could.
Use the Gren!
The cyborg pulled the crystal wand from his shoulder holster. Taking defensive positions behind the top of computers, the troopers readied the explosive charges, ripping off the safety tape, holding the arming lever in place. As if understanding the danger, the hellhound turned and loped for the door. Already facing that direction, Delphi waited until it was directly in sight, then squeezed the wand. Now the Grens flew, raining down around the beast.
Yeah, it's chilled proper. All right, gather the blasters and boots from our dead. Leave the bodies, they'd only be dug up during the night by animals.
Moving slowly, the exhausted crew moved among their fallen comrades, taking what was necessary and ignoring the rest. Death was part of their job. Later, they would mourn for lost friends. Right now, there was still work to be done, as quietly and efficiently as possible. Somebody was going to pay for all this. There was no doubt in Delphi's mind that these bioweapons were part of a trap that had been set just for him. There was no other way that the Hellhounds could have gotten inside a room supposedly sealed for 100 years. Clearly, they had been placed there recently, the doors resealed, and the people in charge of all biological weapons worked for Titan. Going to the smashed computer, Delphi looked over the wreckage. He had hoped that something might have survived the battle. The IBM Blue Gene supercomputer was utterly destroyed. The huge computer was the finest and fastest of its kind in the pre-dark world, and used some of the prototype for the circuits inside his body. The cyborg had fervently hoped to find something he could use here, but that was impossible now. The circuit cubes were broken, the digital wafers shattered, and the plasma chips warped from a series of massive short circuits. With diminishing hope, Delphi went from one server to the next, finding only trash. The last two servers had bullet holes in them, yet were still serviceable and capable of working. Unfortunately, they contained none of the experimental microprocessors that he required. Then inspiration hit. Delphi walked to the control board for the supercomputer and raised the service panel to palm over the complex wiring. Incredibly, he received an answering tingle and dug among the morass of shielded circuits to retrieve a lumpy section of a slim piece of ribbon cable. It was a thinking wire, and almost as advanced as the version that he carried. Even more important, the microchips embedded in the cable seemed completely undamaged. Keeping out of sight behind the raised lid of the console, Delphi opened a port in his chest and fed in the wire. It took a few moments for his systems to initiate the new hardware, and there was a moment of disorientation. Then, whole sections of deactivated programs and hardware became active in his mind. His auto-repair systems were back online. Scrolling through the command menu, he held out a palm, and there appeared a barely visible sheen in the air. Frowning slightly, Delphi rerouted some power, and the translucent distortion expanded to a full yard. Then it turned transparent.
I have a force field again.
Now he was safe from bullets, lasers, anything and everything. Even a focused EMP beam designed to burn out his internal circuitry and render him powerless, paralyzed, a prisoner inside his own augmented body, helpless prey for the agents of Titan. If they were actively hunting for him, then it was time to turn and make a stand.
The balance of power has been redressed. Now the war begins in earnest.
Sir?
Quickly dissolving the force field, Delphi looked up and saw Cotton Davenport standing nearby.
Yes. What is it, Cotton?
We're ready to leave, Chief.
Bellany's gun belt and Webley 44 hung over her arm.
Unless there's something else you want to look for around here.
No. I found what was needed. Let's go.
Where, sir?
East. Let's go home.
After rearming themselves, the companions went to the garage level of the redoubt and checked inside the egg-shaped LAV for anything useful. Delphi had a lot of advanced weaponry they might be able to use against him. Unfortunately, the WAG had seemed to have been stripped to the walls, possibly to make room for the droid to get inside to wait for the cyborg to return. Everything was gone, even the chair from the control board and the engine. The LAV was an empty shell.
Pity.
JB set down a pillowcase full of grins.
However, I can still leave him a little something to remember us by.
Need any help?
Sure. You start stringing the tripwire.
Leaving the two men to their work, the rest of the companions gathered by the towering black doors.
Did anybody else notice that the droid acted as if it could understand what we were saying?
Maybe it could. Intelligent machines were being experimented with in my time. I guess whoever Delphi worked for...
Coldfire. Department Coldfire. I seem to recall that it is a division of over Project Whisper, the lunatics who built the redoubts.
Whitecoats.
Quite right, sir. Thank God the Titan is around to keep... John Barrymore, how is the work progressing?
Puzzled, the three companions glanced at one another.
It'll go faster if you stop jeckling me.
That's heckling.
Whatever.
Are you okay, Doc?
Certainly, my friend. Never better. Why do you ask?
What was that you said about Titan?
The Titans, Dr. Wyeth? Why, those were the ancient giants that the Greek gods stole Mount Olympus from to control the Earth. Fascinating story, but why ever did you ask about them now?
Oh, no reason. I was just thinking about how the droid was like something from Greek mythology, a guardian of the Rainbow Bridge.
That's Norse mythology, madam.
Really? Oh, my mistake.
JB walked backward from the wag, holding up both hands. Jack was also walking down the short flight of stairs. In his hand, Latine was holding a spool of wire. The other end was inside the vehicle, and he was keeping the length very taut.
Easy now, Jack. Steady. This is the tricky part.
Shoo. Tell me something I don't know.
Snipping the wire, both men scrambled to get clear. When nothing happened, they relaxed.
Done and done. When Delphi tries that door, we'll hear it on the other side of the world.
Not be enough left to load empty brass.
Then, pray, let us proceed. The sooner started, the sooner finished. Ergo sum est, eh, my dear Ryan?
Uh-huh. Bet your ass, Doc.
Ryan shared a private look with Christy and Mildred. They were unable to talk freely at the moment with Doc standing among them, but the man's bizarre behavior would be discussed later. Positioning themselves in front of the blast doors in a combat formation, the companion stayed razor sharp while Christy went to the keypad. A wave of cold washed over the companions as they gradually saw a solid wall of rushing water completely blocking the exit.
Dark night, we're under a waterfall!
A fine mist was coming into the tunnel, making everything damp.
Good way to hide a redoubt!
Going to the edge of the slippery floor, Ryan experimentally held out a hand and let the falling cascade impact his fingers. The water hit hard, but not with pummeling force, so this was clearly not a big waterfall.
We're going to need some rope. No way you're going to try to breach that without support.
I get it.
Jack quickly visited the tool room and brought back rope. Ryan took one end and lashed it around himself. The rest of the companions took hold of the other end and tried to brace themselves.
We could loop this once around the wag.
Too risky. Jack and I have that baby rigged to blow if Delphi farts too hard. Stay as far away from that wag as possible.
Understood.
Doc wrapped the end of the rope around his own middle. Seeing that the others had dug in as best they could, Ryan shuffled forward again, moving closer to the edge, feeling the companions tighten the rope lashed around his waist. The cool spray felt refreshing on his face, and squinting his eye, Ryan could almost see through the shimmering wall. This was just camouflage, and not a barrier to keep folks out.
Ready?
Ready!
Ryan placed an arm over his head and stuck his face into the rushing water. The falls pounded on his arms, but not hard enough to knock him over. Extending a foot, he felt nothing beyond the tunnel, then stepped downward with the AK-47. There was no resistance until the weapon was completely submerged. There was a ledge about 4 feet away. Ryan hunched his shoulders and walked further into the waterfall.
Whoa!
There was a moment of disorientation as he fell, then plunged into water. It rose to his chest before his boots hit rock. With the water pouring all around him, Ryan held his breath and waited a moment to make sure it was stable. Then he tugged once on the rope, saying that he was still alive, and got an answering tug before moving forward once more. Carefully placing one boot ahead of the other, he moved from a ledge of smooth rock to an uneven surface that felt like pebbles and stones. He was drenched to the skin by now, and felt that his lungs were about to give out, when he suddenly stepped out of the waterfalls and into open air. Ryan touched the Sig Sauer at his side, scanning the area for any danger. He was standing waist-deep in a wide pool, or rather a small lake, with steeply sloped sides of what looked like red clay. That was when he noticed the moss covering the boulders jutting from the lake and the tall banyan trees lining the shore. Oranges grew in abundance, along with other fruits that Ryan couldn't identify. There were numerous birds sitting in the trees, none of them looking like muties, and then a monkey dashed along the treetops, followed by two more. A motion in the water caught his attention, and Ryan saw a black snake with diamond markings of yellow and blue glide along the bottom of the lake. There was a large lump in its midsection proclaiming a recent kill, but he kept track of its progress until the snake was out of sight. Glancing at the sky, Ryan saw the usual maelstrom of purple and orange clouds filling the heavens, the occasional bolt of lightning zipping from one cloud to strike another. Tugging on the rope for more play, Ryan started to wade toward shore. A school of tiny fish, resembling an underwater rainbow, darted past him. That made Ryan ease his stance slightly. If there were any large predators in the pool, the fish would be long gone. But he still kept a careful watch for the return of the diamondback snake. Most animals killed for food, but there were some that killed others just because they could. Reaching the shore, Ryan maneuvered clumsily through the ankle-deep mud and crawled onto dry ground. The grass was freckled with tiny flowers, and he recognized them as the same type found inside the Matran's chamber. The cyborg had been here. Slowly straightening, Ryan studied the thick jungle. Straight ahead was a sort of path, the thick bushes mashed to the ground. Past the bushes was a broken stand of bamboo, the splintered shafts scattered around, and the stumps already a yard high. That looked like the passage of a heavy wag to Ryan. With the egg-shaped wag inoperable, the cyborg would have needed new transportation. There could have been anything parked in the garage, even an APC or a tank. Kneeling, Ryan examined the crushed leaves, but there was no sign of tire tracks or tread marks. And bamboo was the fastest-growing plant in the world, according to Mildred. Under the right conditions, it could rise several inches a day. Which meant there was no way to even guess how long it had been since the wag or wags forced their way through the dense foliage, but certainly no more than a week. That matched the condition of the flowers in the Matrans. Delphi had been here only a few days ago. A weak tug came on the rope, and Ryan jerked back twice in reply, saying it was safe for the others to exit. As the rope went slack, he holstered his gun and started undoing the knot. Huh. It had gotten awfully quiet all of a sudden. Ryan clawed for the 6 hour as he saw a large figure moving in the shadows under a banyan tree. A huge gorilla-like animal with four arms rushed into the light.
Fire blast!
The hideous creature grabbed Ryan, wrapping all four arms around his chest, squeezing with monstrous strength. Ryan wiggled the 6 hour against the dark fur. The grip loosened slightly. Managing to get an arm free, Ryan shoved the gun under the mutie's jaw. As the arms dropped away, Ryan kicked the mutie, but the blow seemed to have no effect. As the dying animal staggered away, blood gushing from the ghastly wounds. Then it turned and charged again. With no time to reload, Ryan dropped the 6 hour and drew his punga to meet the charge. As Ryan slashed out, the mutie stumbled to the side, trying to get around him. Ryan lashed out again with the flat of his blade. The mutie grabbed at the ruin of its slashed neck. Ryan yanked the AK-47 off his shoulder. Ryan grabbed the 6 hour from the grass and shoved the empty weapon back into its holster, never looking away from the steaming jungle.
Ugh.
His ribs ached, but they weren't broken. He'd encountered that type of mutie previously, and they always traveled in packs. He had to get back into the redoubt fast. Stepping awkwardly down the slope, Ryan saw something move in the trees. As he waded back through the lake, 6 more muties dropped from the trees and charged. Incredibly, they paused at the edge of the water. Ryan raised the AK-47. Furious, they jumped in and waded forward, with all of their arms raised. Ryan tried to jump aside, but something hard tugged around his waist, stopping him.
What the?
The rope was still tied around his middle and was tangled on a rock.
Shit!
He had to cut the rope loose, or he would never leave the water alive. Ryan clawed for the panga, but felt only empty leather. Then he spotted the blade on the mossy grass, lying amid the delicate flowers.
Fuck!
Spreading out, the muties began to circle him in the shallow lake. Ryan had to conserve ammo. They were just waiting for him to have to reload. Suddenly, Christy and JB stepped into view on either side of Ryan, their Kalashnikovs in hand. The remaining muties turned to flee back into the jungle.
Watch the trees!
Shaking the moisture off his glasses, JB was about to say something when Christy swung her AK-47. bleeding mutie disappeared into the lush plants.
Cover me!
Nodding, Christy and JB raised their Kalashnikovs, ready to kill anything that moved. Pausing at the shallows, Ryan scanned the area, then darted forward to grab his panga and rush back into the lake. Several hairy muties jumped into view and rushed to the edge of the pool, waving their arms. But not one of the creatures entered the water.
Why don't they want to come into the water? Are there snakes or something?
I don't think they're allowed in.
Yeah. Ryan slashed the rope with the panga.
You mean they're like obedient guard dogs?
Right. And we know that Delphi likes to use trained muties. Let's get back to the redoubt.
You don't have to suggest that twice.
Back in the redoubt, Ryan explained what had happened outside.
I know them muties. They called hunters. Shit, what we do?
Well, we're not going through that jungle on foot, that's for triple damn sure. Those things would kill the lot of us in minutes, no matter how much ammo we're carrying.
Mildred looked sideways at the white wag.
Pity we can't ride out of here.
Why can't we?
JB, didn't you say that thing had been completely gutted?
It is, but there are lots of civvy wags in the garage. I'm sure we can do something with them.
They're useless. Those muties would rip off the doors easily.
Not if they are surrounded by a protective grill. Remember those bikes that Silas used in Tennessee? They had a cage around them for protection. Mayhap we can do something similar.
Only one bike in the garage, but a lot of trucks. Those work good. Need a cage.
We can make them. The redoubt has plenty of power, so the electric arc welders will be working. All we need is some steel bars.
Where we get them?
The armory. That has all the hardened steel we could possibly use.
Blasters? We gut long blasters?
Why not? We have more than we can use, and the barrels are perfect for what we need. Strong and light.
Shit, but we ruined the blasters.
Jack!
Oh, all right. Come on. If needs to be done, best do quick.
Good man. But first, we eat.
Afterward, Jack and I have to defuse this. There's no way for us to get another wag through this tunnel with this thing blocking the way. And one hard shove will set off a blast louder than Skydark.
Fair enough.
Dr. Edgar Franklin straightened his collar as he rode the elevator down to the middle level. Titan expected him to perform certain duties, and this was the day he'd chosen to inspect the Rhode Island redoubt. Appearances always mattered to him. His usual attire was hospital scrubs and sneakers. Loose and comfortable, they let a man breathe and think. But for this day's chore, he decided to wear combat fatigues, a wide gun belt holstering a military-issue pistol, and knee-high jack boots. He couldn't have been more uncomfortable if he were wearing a straitjacket. He walked into the waiting Matrans chamber and headed toward the keypad. With the door closed, the jump was activated. A mist rose from the ceiling and floor, masking his vision. There was a brief moment of disorientation. The mists receded, revealing a different redoubt. Stepping from the unit, Franklin stopped in puzzlement.
Where the hell am I?
He wasn't in Rhode Island. According to the colors on the wall, this redoubt was located in Antarctica. Franklin went into the control room. Pressing a palm to a blank section of the board, he accessed the secondary systems and ran a quick diagnostic of the unit to see what was wrong. There could have been a major malfunction. Possibly, Whisper had lost another redoubt. Several had been destroyed in the nuclear war, an expected and accepted loss. Then a few were damaged by natural disasters, earthquakes, volcanoes, and the like. Incredibly, one had been flooded of all things, and another was nuked out of existence only a few years ago. Yet there was no scientific explanation of how a nuclear warhead from the war could have waited that long to finally detonate. Some fool in Titan security had suggested that a handful of survivors from the outside had used a tactical nuke to destroy the base, which was patently ridiculous.
As if their uneducated brains could possibly learn how to operate a portable nuclear weapon, much less gain entry into a redoubt. The savages roaming the so-called Deathlands barely know how to make fire. Their pitiful ragtag civilization are reduced to the level of wooden clubs, which are hardly capable of causing damage to a $100 billion fortress. Still, a puzzling problem.
A light flashed on the console, announcing the diagnostic was complete. All of the programs reported that the matter transfer unit was functioning normally. Every primary computer system in the green,
and every defensive subsystem fully operating within normal parameters.
Very strange.
Consulting the electronic PDA strapped to his wrist, Franklin returned to the Matrans unit and slowly tapped in the Rhode Island destination code once more. Once more, the mists rose. As the mists fell, he checked the walls. He was at the Panama Canal.
Son of a bitch.
It seemed the redoubt in Rhode Island was somehow blocked. Logically, there were only three distinct possibilities. The first, and most likely, was that the redoubt had suffered a technical problem of some kind, a dysfunction or a malfunction. Or two, the redoubt had been destroyed. Not at all likely, but theoretically possible. Unfortunately, the third option was the most unsettling. There was something blocking the Matrans chamber at the redoubt. Checking the files in the PDA, Franklin finally found the command sequence that he needed to override whatever blocked his jump. He stepped back into the antechamber. Waiting patiently, he kept his pistol up and ready. Again, the white mist filled the chamber.
What the hell?
The mist faded away to reveal a stack of wooden cases. Curiously, Franklin holstered his weapon. Prying one of the crates open with his bare fingers, he scowled at the spongy Excelsior stuffing and impatiently brushed it aside to reveal a human arm with silvery wires dangling from the shoulder joint. Instantly, he recognized it as an artificial limb used for battlefield repairs and to create cyborgs. But that was impossible. Every cyborg had been decommissioned by Coldfire, except for one, the Great Traitor, the sworn enemy of Titan.
Delphi is back.
While the others were preparing dinner, Ryan got Mildred and Christy alone for a few minutes in one of the officers' quarters by pretending his ribs were especially bad. It really didn't require a lot of faking on his part. When his shirt came off, dark purple and black bruises were encircling his entire torso, and on his back were the clear imprints of four inhuman hands. Staying near the door to keep a watch out for Doc, Christy frowned at the sight of the discoloration, but said nothing.
And this happened after you shot the hunter? I've seen worse, but not on anybody who survived.
Just glad I got in as much press as I did. That son of a bitch was strong.
More than you, that's for sure.
Mildred rummaged inside her medical kit.
I can give you some aspirin to help you sleep tonight.
She wrapped a small bandage tight around Ryan to help his ribs heal faster.
Okay, now that's done, let's get to the real reason we're here. What the fucking hell was the problem with Doc? He starts talking about something called Titan and goes blank, like the man never heard of the people he was just talking about.
He mentioned Coldfire, too, but he's talked about that before. This Titan was new.
Well, it could be some sort of a mental block. Maybe something happened to him that was so horrible he's blocked it from his memory. No, that makes no sense. He was brutally tortured by Court Strasser before you busted him loose, and he remembers every damn minute of that.
But if that's true, this is something else. Not a block, but more like, I don't know, like a bungee cord. He's free to move about, say, and think what he wants, but if Doc goes too far and mentions Titan, then it snaps him back hard.
Depending upon how wide the perimeters of the block are, this might explain a lot about his odd lapses of memory.
True.
Could this be that stuff you told us about, Mildred? Hypnotism?
No, that's only a tool for psychoanalysis. The doctor induces a state of monomaniac in the patient, but it's easily broken. Hypnotism has been used a lot in the movies to turn people into robots, but that doesn't work in the real world. Hell, hypnotists can barely make folks stop smoking, much less turn them into slaves.
So, is there anything we can do?
Unfortunately, no. Damn it to hell, I wish there was something to be done. Oh, I've read several books, attended lectures, taken some mandatory classes, but still, even if I had the proper psychotropic drugs, I'm only an amateur. If I tried digging around in Doc's head, I might make him worse. A lot worse.
Great.
Then we do nothing for the moment.
Except offer him our friendship and support. And listen closely if he ever mentions Titan again. With enough pieces of the puzzle, we might have a chance of finding a solution. But until then...
It's like planning a night creep. Until we know more about the enemy, what kind of segment they have, are there dogs, booby traps, and such, any wreck is just going to get us chilled.
That's a pretty fair analogy.
Food's done!
Ryan and Christy helped Mildred gather her med supplies, and the three of them walked from the room, lost in their own somber thoughts. Ryan was swimming through the cool green water of the nameless lake, odd columns of red rock rising upward, like the weathered pylons from some ancient temple. A raging fury filled him, and his exhaustion faded away, to be replaced with a hard determination. He wasn't going to get killed out here in the middle of nowhere. He had to find the convoy before it was too late. Some small part of his mind said that it may already be too late. The traitor could be lying on the side of the road, killed by the Stickies. Or worse, the convoy had taken off and was now miles away. But Ryan ignored that thought. He had fought bigger men than himself, stronger, meaner men. Yet he always won, because he didn't quit. Unfortunately, there were only sheer rock walls in every direction he turned. Unclimbable cliffs, with no place to get out of the water larger than a spent brass. Then he caught a glimmer of white that instinctively started paddling in that direction. As he got closer, he saw there was an adobe vill sitting on a pebbled shore. Oddly, there was no wall surrounding the cluster of buildings, which naturally made him think it was a pre-dark town that had somehow survived Skydark. Yet there weren't any telephone poles sticking out of the ground or cars parked along the curbs that he could see from this angle. His rage was starting to ebb away, his strength fading, when Ryan felt the toe of his boot scrape ground under the green water. He dragged himself out of the lake and flopped bonelessly on the bed of pebbles. The smooth rocks were hot from the sunlight, and the soothing warmth seeped into his aching body like a healing balm. Ryan rose from the stony beach and walked stiffly toward the adobe vill, diligently searching for any signs of muties or cold hearts. The place seemed deserted, and there was nothing dangerous in sight. Yet he was oddly apprehensive. Then it hit him. The buildings were adobe, dried mud bricks, with wooden poles sticking out of the sides to support the red clay tile roofs. But most of them reached 4, 5, even 6 stories tall, which was flat out impossible for adobe. The mud bricks couldn't take that much weight, unless there was another structure underneath supporting them.
This is a fake. Someplace made to look primitive to hide the real buildings. Might be an underground cache like the traitor uses.
Warily, the 20-year-old man drew his Colt 45 auto weapon. That was when he noticed one building that seemed different from the rest. It was a little blurry to Ryan's vision, as if his eyes were tired. Advancing closer, Ryan studied the structure. It was a 3-story adobe building, red tile roof, wooden shutters over the windows, and a weathered door with some kind of a glowing symbol set into the lintel. A sort of circle with an oval going across sideways, with a large star set off center to the left. Suddenly, Ryan found himself standing in the middle of a weedy road. Then, a wool wag came over a low hillock, closely followed by several more. He couldn't believe it. That was the convoy. War Wag 1 came to a rocking halt.
Well, Nuke Me Flat. Look who we have here.
Never thought I'd see your sorry ass again, Carter. Nice to have you back.
Behind you!
The traitor swung up his weapon. Ducking, Ryan swiveled to see a white mist rise from a depression among the weeds. Then a nest of ropey tentacles lashed madly about. The creature pushed up through the weeds, the plants turning brown and withering at the passage of the hellish thing. Ryan opened his eye to see the bedroom of the redoubt.
Lover, you all right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was just that damn dream again.
After a hurried breakfast of beef stew, canned bread, and black coffee, the companions went directly to work on the wags. They broke only for lunch, and by late afternoon, the job was completed. Stepping back from the pre-dark machine, Ryan wiped his sweaty forehead and studied the last weld on the final cage. It looked good, but he had to make sure. Grabbing the hot metal with a gloved hand, Ryan shook it hard, but the gridwork stayed firm and unyielding.
They were ready to go. After ascertaining that the cyborg's LAV was safe to move, the companions had dragged it into the garage and shoved it out of the way in a disused corner. Then JB and Jack rigged the egg-smooth vehicle once more, this time adding a coffin full of live brass to the mix. When the WAG detonated, the entire garage level would be filled with a maelstrom of shrapnel. To be honest, JB didn't know if that could kill Delphi, but it sure was going to be spectacular. Half of the armorer wanted to see the staggering blast, but the rest of him wanted to be as far away from the devastation as possible. The best of the civilian WAGs had been carefully chosen and completely disassembled. Each vehicle was reduced to bare framework, then rebuilt. The engines raised higher than the lake outside, and the exhaust pipes altered to go straight up. The companions had also added a reinforced fuel tank, an entire row of nuke batteries, and a single seat for the driver. Surrounding the crude speedster was a strong cage made of gun barrels, removed from the stores of Kalashnikovs. The hollow bars were set with care at what the companions sincerely hoped was a couple of inches farther away from the driver than the reach of a hunter. There were still a few extra Kalashnikovs remaining, so each took two. Everything else in the armory had been either set with a trap or destroyed by the arc welder.
Wish we had the time to add some spikes to the cage, or make them stronger. If a weld pops, a bar can come loose, and then we'd be easy pickings.
Not so easy.
Jack jerked a wrist, and a knife appeared in his palm. The freshly sharpened blade gleamed.
Yeah, I know, but still...
Don't worry, John. The doors will do.
Sure as hell hope so.
Normally, they would have waited for another day or two so that they could add some refinements, but unfortunately, time was against them. The longer the companions waited, the farther Delphi got from the redoubt. Or worse, the sooner he jumped to the redoubt, see that his spare parts were gone, and attack from within, driving them out to the muties waiting arms. By the fuel pumps, Doc was holding a hose over a bucket. Hanging up the nozzle, he lifted the bucket by the handle and carried it to the last speedster. Using a cardboard funnel, the man carefully poured in the few pints of clear fluid. Christy was sitting behind the wheel.
How much juice did we achieve, dear lady?
That put me at a little more than half a tank. You sure there's no more?
Mayhap in another redoubt.
Fair enough.
Hopefully it would be enough fuel to get them through the jungle and far enough away from the hunters. On open ground, the creatures were relatively easy to kill, but in their natural environment, they were death machines. There was no doubt in Christie's mind that the gorilla-like muties would have killed Ryan if they'd been allowed to enter the pool. That had been a foolish mistake by Delphi. Many fights were lost because somebody acted stupid, more than anything else. Ryan climbed into the lead speedster. The crew door was painted a bright yellow, oddly marking its exact position in the resilient cage. He checked over the few gauges still attached to the skeletal remains of the dashboard. Everything looked good. Everyone seemed satisfied with his or her speedster, except for JB, who still wished for something other than the Volvo SUV. It was a good WAG, but relatively new, and he had hoped for something older. The trader always said that old metal ran better, and it was true. The flashy models produced just before the big flash all had electric carburetors, fuel injectors, built-in computers, and the like. So even if they somehow survived the nuke war without getting fried, the fancy engines were a real pain in the ass to maintain.
Everybody hot?
Hands gave curt waves as the companions did a last check on their speedsters, making sure that all of the food and general supplies were lashed down tight, the rapid fires loaded, spare ammo tucked away safely, along with the grens. Each person had an AK-47 set in a pressure clip on the floor, far from the questing hands of the muties, yet readily available to them if the need should arise. But more importantly, every speedster had a rubber mat glued to the floor under the driver.
Ready and willing. Just say the word.
Let's roll!
Forming a ragged line, the six speedsters rolled into the exit tunnel, maneuvering easily past the series of anti-red zigzags.
Half a league onward!
Aw, stop it, you old coot! You know I hate that damn poem!
Hate Tennyson, madam? Impossible!
Maybe just hate you!
Oh, now that I believe!
The massive blast doors at the end of the tunnel loomed. Christy hopped out to tap in the exit code on the wall keypad. He immediately raced back to his speedster. Anxiously, Ryan touched the fresh bandages under his shirt as he waited to see if any of the muties would come out of the rushing barrier. But nothing happened.
All right, then!
Shooting forward, Ryan literally flew through the water and was airborne for several seconds. Veering away from a boulder, he jogged to the left just as Christy burst into view. Steering wildly, the companions did their best to avoid the assorted obstacles submerged in the shallow lake. Ryan searched for hunters waiting for them in the trees or bushes. With them, the shore was upon them. Angling past a tree, Ryan plowed into a shrub.
Ah, damn it!
Savagely twisting the steering wheel, he fought to stay out of the water and managed to angle back into the bushes. Ryan rejoined the others, rocketing through the dense jungle. JB gave Ryan a game thumbs up, and Christy nodded. Then they were among the banyan trees. Hanging vines were everywhere, and the companions concentrated on their driving. Colorful birds flew from the trees at their approach, and the little monkeys ran away, waving their arms in an almost human manner. Suddenly, something heavy landed on top of Ryan's cage. A hairy arm clawed for Ryan's face. Leaning away from the limb, Ryan reached for a switch on the dashboard. The entire cage came alive with fat blue sparks. On the dashboard, a meter showed the first line of new batteries in the rear of the speedster draining slightly, but nothing serious. With electric charges crawling over it, the mutie blindly tried for Ryan, missed, and accidentally touched the door. A second set of batteries surged, completing the circuit. The mutie burst into flames and plummeted from the cage. Ryan smelled ozone and cooked flesh. Unfortunately, the gas cage was dropping at an alarming rate. But there was nothing that could be done about that. He would just have to stay low, stay fast, and trust that the welds were strong enough to hold. Another mutie leapt from a bush, all four arms spread. Dodging the creature, Ryan saw the other companions in their speedsters darting about. Jack had a dead mutie on the front, partially blocking his view. He was having little luck getting it off. A large mutie was clinging to the side of Doc's cage, holding on with both feet, while four hands grabbed for the old man's long flowing hair. Ryan could see the scholar stabbing the button on the dashboard, but nothing was happening. Quickly angling in that direction, Ryan saw Christy slam her speedster into Doc's wag, crushing the mutie between their two cages. A gory ruin, the charred hunter hung on with a single arm, then fell away to disappear in the clouds of bluish smoke pouring from the exhaust pipes. Only the arm remained to sway to the motions of the racing speedster. Ryan turned to see a hunter perched on top of Mildred's cage, bleeding from a score of wounds. The mutie thrust downward with a stick, knocking the Kalashnikov from Mildred's grip.
Shit!
The AK-47 tumbled to the rear of the speedster, lying on top of the nuke batteries. If the metal weapon made contact with the terminals, Mildred would be fried alive. Jack turned his speedster while gripping his Colt Python and fired a magnum round at a tree branch ahead of Mildred's vehicle. The falling branch hit the bleeding mutie across the face. He toppled from the cage, and JB ran over the fallen hunter, grinning like a madman. Then Mildred slammed on the brakes, and the Kalashnikov flew to the front of the cage and dropped onto the dashboard. There were spaces among the trees now, and occasionally Ryan could see open sky. They had to be reaching the end of the jungle. He had no idea what lay beyond, but without the cover provided by the trees, the danger from the muties would be eliminated. Suddenly, a rock bounced off the cage near Ryan. Stony splinters peppered his face.
Fire blast!
He veered away from the attack, then realized his mistake and spun back again, just in time to avoid a barrage of rocks thrown by other muties. Suddenly, Ryan was out of the jungle, barreling along an uneven grassland that stretched to the horizon. The five companions followed. The muties were not allowed in the lake, so it made sense that they were also not allowed out of the jungle. Guards weren't any good if they could run away. The terrain was getting rougher now, wild and jagged. Ryan turned to see Jack shaking his head vehemently and heading to the west. Ryan was puzzled for a moment, then understood that the team was still following the trail of Delphi from the redoubt. Ryan and the others followed Jack through the churned countryside and onto a smooth grassland. Young trees dotted the landscape, but they were few and far between and easily avoided. Squinting at the grass, Ryan caught a glimpse of the signs of an old campsite. There had been four cook fires, which meant that 15 or so people could be traveling with the cyborg. Ryan wanted to go back to look for more details about the weapons and wags of the cyborg's convoy, but they were still too close to the muties to risk stopping. Ryan's fuel gauge needle was trembling near the quarter tank mark. Half of their juice was already gone. There was a faint smell of sulfur in the air. A storm was brewing. Ryan fought the urge to increase his speed and stayed close to Jack. If they lost the trail now, they would never find it again after an acid rain. On the other hand, if they were caught out in the open, after the storm, there wouldn't be enough of the companions left to stuff into an empty cartridge. Casting fast glances to the other companions, Ryan saw that they comprehended the situation and wanted to stay on the trail. There really was nothing else to do but keep moving and hope they outpaced the coming rain.